from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
My fellow Americans, tonight I am speaking to you because there is a growing humanitarian and security crisis at our southern border.
That was President Donald Trump last night taking his case for a border wall directly to the American people. Fact checkers were quick to point out that the number of people caught trying to cross illegally is at the lowest levels in decades. In her response, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi tried to redirect attention to the government shutdown.
President Trump must stop holding the American people hostage, must stop manufacturing a crisis, and must reopen the government.
Coming up on Forum, we'll fact-check last night's Oval Office address, talk about the reality of what's happening on the southern border, and get the latest on the shutdown next after this news. Welcome to this morning's Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're going to be talking this hour about President Trump's Oval Office speech on the border wall last night, but first, President Trump tweeted earlier today that he is cutting off federal money to fight California wildfires, claiming the money is being wasted. And we're joined now by KQED Politics and government reporter Marisa Lagos. And welcome, Marisa.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Well, this is a tweet and it's a threat, or is it actually something that's in operation?
Well, unclear. As often happens with the president's sort of early morning tweets, you know, this came out. KQED, many of us have been reaching out to FEMA and to other officials, both in state and federal government, trying to get a hold on whether this is actually something that's happening or not. We haven't gotten any confirmation. KQED News has actually chosen not to report on this until we have a little more clear understanding. And I think the context is important because we've seen this happen before. We've seen the president make sort of sweeping statements threatening California with funding around emergencies. And I think it's important to note that in the past, at least, it's never those threats have never been realized. The feds have always stepped up, whether it was the Oroville Dam crisis, whether it's the fires that have swept the state over the last 2 years. And so I think that, you know, one thing we're all trying to do in the media is be responsible and figure out what this means. Of course, it's the president, but, you know, it's a pretty, in some ways, vague statement. He's saying, I've ordered FEMA to send no more money unless they get their act together on forest management. So that's pretty similar to what he said in the past. And again, those threats didn't materialize.
Yeah, he's talking again about improper forest management and cash outlay in the billions because of that. But there's also, and I'd like to get your read on this, there's also apparently some movement now of not only California under new Governor Newsom's leadership, but also along with Oregon and Washington to essentially ask for a doubling of federal funding to manage forest lands.
Yeah, and it's, again, unclear if the timing of this is related to that. I mean, I was at the news conference yesterday up in the Sierra foothills in the town of Colfax, where the new governor, Gavin Newsom, stood alongside everyone from the head of CAL FIRE and the state CHP and emergency services and the head of the National Guard to talk about the need for, the state to do more, obviously, and some initiatives that he was rolling out, but also for this appeal to the federal government. And what these governors of all three western states wrote is that, you know, we've all put tens of millions of dollars in recent years into forest health. And in contrast, the U.S. Forest Service has seen its budget cut by more than $2 billion since the president took office a couple of years ago. And so I think that, there's a lot of also just like factual things that I think are important to clarify here. One of which is that most of the fires we've seen have not been forest fires. I mean, clearly we do need better forest management. I think that's something everyone across the political spectrum agrees with. But if you look at what happened in Paradise with the Camp Fire in Sonoma and Napa counties with the Atlas and Tubbs fires, these did start in areas where there's a wildland-urban interface, but they quickly spread and became really more suburban and urban been blazes. And so I think that, you know, there's a lot of just sort of confusion when the president puts out statements like this that aren't totally based on what we're seeing on the ground here in California.
Well, just remember, he tweeted that he was going to be pulling out of Syria, or we'd be pulling out of Syria, and that seemed to change over a few days. But Marisa, I appreciate very much your reporting. We will obviously continue to follow this story. And that's Marisa Lagos, KQED Politics and Government Reporter. Thank you, Marisa.
My pleasure, Michael.
Well, let me bring Ron Elving on. Ron Elving, of course, is senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk of NPR News. And Ron, what do you make out of this latest tweet before we go to the president's speech last night?
It does seem to be very much in that category that you were describing a moment ago. The president has also in recent days threatened to shut the border with Mexico, close down all transactions between the two countries, shut down all transportation between the two countries. He's done that before. He's never actually done it. Virtually no one thinks he could possibly be serious about that, considering it's a $600 billion a year relationship, not to mention the millions of people who would be involved. And as a result, the president just likes to tweet things like this. He likes to say that he is going to shut down a border or pull our troops out of a country, and then the people around him have to scramble for days, weeks, to either contain the damage or deny that it's even happening in the first place.
I want to talk with you, Ron, in some detail about last night's speech, but before I do, I'm going to go to Salvador Rizzo, who is a reporter for the for the Fact Checker, which is in the Washington Post. And Salvador, good to have you back with us on Forum. Welcome.
Great to be with you.
Let's begin by talking about some of the facts from last night's speech with you. I mean, your column in the Post said from the first sentence the president had to be challenged in terms of reliability or credibility, talking about this being a security crisis at the southern border.
Yes, so the speech got off on a wrong foot in terms of fact checkers, you know, how they would see it. Certainly we saw it as a piece of the puzzle with President Trump since he's been a candidate. He has promoted the false, construct that immigration leads to more crime. Reputable research that, you might come across says the opposite. You know, legal and illegal immigration tends to lower crime rates where those individuals settle in the United States. And so from the very top of the speech, the president described the situation along the U.S.-Mexico border as a security crisis. And he said that this was the time to act, that it was an inflection point, that he profiled, a few instances, a few select cases of illegal immigrants who committed violent, gory crimes, and he did it in detail. He's talking about drugs and overdose deaths in the United States, and it's all one big ball of misleading and carefully constructed deception. If you're wondering, what a security crisis looks like at the border, I would point everyone to the year 2000 when there were 1.6 million apprehensions of people trying to cross illegally. In fiscal year 2018, the number was below 400,000, and there has been 20 years of steady decline in the number of border apprehensions. So the idea that this is a new and urgent and, a dangerous crisis at the border is just a false construct.
There is, however, a humanitarian crisis with all these families trying to come in, and we'll talk with Julie Small later in this hour about that, KQED's criminal justice and immigration team. But I want to talk with you a little bit more about misstatements and, well, lies for that matter. I mean, when the president talks, for example, about thousands of people coming in, illegal immigrants trying to enter the country, I think you could say hundreds safely at this point. But also, you mentioned drugs, and you've got the president talking about all these drugs coming through. And the fact of the matter is he's totally ignoring the fact that most of these drugs are coming through legal entry points.
That's right. And so the irony here is that the proposal that is being discussed in Congress that has Republican and Democrat support would significantly enhance, border agents' ability to interdict, smugglers and drugs and all that kind of stuff. It would provide new technology, training, and resources for beefed up, interdiction of those drugs at legal ports of entry. A wall would not necessarily stop the flow of commerce. You know, all these trucks and trailers and individuals and vans would still be crossing. The opportunity to smuggle drugs inside those vehicles would still be there. The DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, reports every year that only a very small percentage of the drugs that are interdicted on the border are not at ports of entry people are trying to smuggle them through, while they're crossing, somewhere along the wilderness.
One thing that the president didn't say that he'd been saying right up to the speech was that there are terrorists coming in. He seemed to obviate that. And the fact of the matter is that the State Department said there's no credible evidence of that. But there was an outright lie in the speech last night, a couple of them. One of the perhaps biggest ones or most obvious ones was the fact that somehow Mexico is paying for the new trade deal with NAFTA for this wall, as he promised in his campaign. Mexico would pay for it. This is nonsense. Mexico is not paying, and the trade deal doesn't mean really that Mexico is putting forth money.
The trade deal isn't even ratified yet, and you're right. I mean, it is nonsense. That's not how trade deals for trade works. There's no account. There's no bank account where money is deposited by Mexican consumers or individuals for the purpose of building a wall. It's all based on the theory, you know, which is not entirely divorced from reality, but, you know, very divorced. The theory that the trade deal would spur economic activity in the United States and the added tax revenue collected by the government from that activity, you know, could be repurposed for the wall. But it's all in terms of, you know, I mean, there are so many things that affect GDP, trade, and tax revenue that you can't rely on, you know, you don't even know what kind of revenue you'll be getting yet. The deal isn't ratified, and it's not how it works. And at the end of the day, you still need an appropriation from Congress to be able to build stuff with the money that you're collecting from taxes.
What about his putting forth the argument that Democrats really want a steel barrier, or have said and are on record as wanting a steel barrier instead of a concrete one?
That was sort of the curveball that we all that pricked all of our ears last night as we were listening. There is no Democrat who's on record saying, you know, if you do a steel wall instead, we'll happily go along. It's zero, not even one of them. And so this proposal has been floated by the White House, including by Mick Mulvaney, the acting chief of staff, and presumably it's come up in the discussions that top officials in the Trump administration are having with Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, and other Democrats. But it's wrong to say that Democrats are requesting it. There's no evidence of that, and they deny it.
Salvador, there's much more we could pick apart here, but I think we've got to the main elements that I wanted to get to, and I thank you so much for joining us. That's Salvador Rizzo, reporter for the Fact Checker at The Washington Post. And Ron Elving, as I said, is joining us, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News. And Julie Small is here in studio. She's a reporter for KQED's Criminal Justice and Immigration Team. Let me officially welcome you, Judy.
Thank you.
Good to have you. And let me go back, Ron, to you, and let's assess what actually was said by the president last night. He was trying to convince the American people. And the real question, I guess, is are they buying what he was selling?
There seems to be little question that the real audience for President Trump's speech last night was not the entirety of the American people, and certainly not the Democrats who are opposing him in Congress. There seemed to be no effort whatsoever to woo or win them over. It seems that this is another instance of the president talking to those people who matter to him most at this juncture of his presidency, perhaps throughout his presidency, and that's the people who voted for him in 2016 and have continued to stand by him since. An extraordinary number of them have stood by him, Michael. They have told pollsters in extraordinary numbers, 85-90% of Republicans, that they approve of what he's doing. And most of that number, although not quite at that astronomic level, have said that they actually also approve of his wall. They want his wall with Mexico. And many of them, although not, again, at that kind of numbers, more like about 50% of the Republicans, say they think it's okay to shut down the government for a while in order to pressure the Democrats to do it. So the president is showing that he's fighting. The president is showing that he is hanging tough and using every weapon that's available to a sitting president, including sitting down behind the Resolute desk and having an Oval Office address to the nation, to try to win this fight. That is what is most necessary for him right now, and the reasons for that are stronger than ever. He needs his base more than ever, and we'll have a chance to talk about that, I think, as the program goes on.
Yeah, he is also maybe talking directly to people like Ann Coulter and Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and showing them that he can sit tough and sit in front of the American people in a tough way. The real question that continues to loom over this discussion, though, about who the president is playing to and why, is there some cracking in the Republican wall that has stood up behind him and that continues to stand up behind him, let alone the base?
That is the case. And in fact, in this hour, the president is going to Capitol Hill to meet with a Republican policy committee on the Senate side, composed of some of the senators who have been his stronger backers, but also some people who have had their doubts, mostly in private, about what the president's strategy might be overall with regard to immigration, certainly with regard to the wall, and most particularly with regard to the shutdown, which is simply not popular. People don't think it makes sense to shut down this portion of the government, a quarter of the government, to have 800,000 people not being paid, to have services being under a shadow, if not actually interrupted yet. And so a lot of these Republicans are saying they might get behind a bill to reopen parts of the government or possibly even to steamroll the president entirely. And the president is going to Capitol Hill, as they say, in this hour, to try to shore up his support among Republican senators, while Mike Pence has been dispatched to talk to Republican House members, apparently dozens of whom are now willing to vote for bills to reopen the government, at least piecemeal, if not the Department of Homeland Security in particular. And that is a crisis within the crisis within the crisis for the president and his vice president, and they're trying to address it even as we speak.
Talking with Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR News, and the president indeed is going up to Capitol Hill today. He's going down to the border tomorrow, and I thought we'd check in with Julie Small, who's here with us in studio as a reporter for KQED's criminal justice and immigration team, who has been spot on in terms of reporting from the border. And let's just get a picture from you, Julie. There is a sense, well, first of all, ongoing suffering, but from what I'm reading, I want to talk about that with you, it's not so much catch and release anymore. It's catch and can't release.
Yeah, I mean, you catch them. You can't hold on to them, actually. The president had made a statement that he was going to no longer do catch and release. It was going to be catch and detain. But actually, people are being released more quickly now because of the crowding in the Border Patrol facilities, especially following the death of two toddlers in those facilities.
And what is the role of ICE in all this? I mean, we're reading, for example, that Border Patrol and customs people are behind the president in the desire for a wall. And, you know, a lot of Democrats to the far left, the Democrats are saying do away with ICE. How do you see their role playing in this?
Well, I don't see them going away. And I would imagine, you know, with so many people coming, there's always going to be a need for ICE to process them. I mean, even if we release people immediately, they do go through a process with ICE where we find out who they are, where they're coming from, and where they're going and where we can find them so that we can make sure they show up at their court dates.
And many of them are not showing up at their court dates. I mean, they've been calling out names left and right without necessarily people appearing. You're talking to some of the people who are trying to get asylum and trying to get entry into the United States. Some very poignant stories. Give us a sense, for example, of what you've discovered.
Well, I went to San Antonio to the bus station there, the Greyhound bus station, because that is where people who have come, families who've been detained, are released right to that bus station. And I was able to speak with several people. One man in particular from El Salvador, he had come with his 7-year-old son. He said, you know, I didn't want to come here. I love my country. I wanted to stay there. That's where my life is. The reason he came was that his neighbors were murdered, and he says he knows who did it. And then a friend of his told him, look, I've heard that you're going to be next. And the next day, that friend disappeared. And that's when he made the decision to leave. And he had to leave his mother behind. You know, as he was sitting there describing what he'd been through, he was weeping, quietly weeping and saying, you know, this is not the way I wanted my life to go. I've come to the United States because I have to.
Julie Small with us in studio, reporter for KQED's criminal justice and immigration team. We'll come back and talk with her some more. But let me go back to you, Ron Elving, and talk about last night and what was – so it was not said that terrorists are trying to get in here by the president. And the other thing that I noticed and many noticed as well was he didn't say anything about circumventing Congress and declaring an emergency through executive order.
The talk of an emergency declaration was possibly, one could think, to encourage the networks which were dithering about this or trying to decide on Monday whether or not to give him this airtime. It would have been a terrible humiliation for the president, particularly given his predilections for television, to be told by the broadcast networks that they would not give him this time that presidents have traditionally had. Now, they did refuse that to President Obama once back in 2013. 2014 when he wanted to talk about immigration on television. And that was quite a setback for the president at that time, even though President Obama was not given to Oval Office declarations or speeches and did not really care that much for that particular device. President Obama did use it 3 times, and he wanted to use it 1 time. He was denied because they said, you're not going to be making news. There's no big crisis. There's no big announcement to be made. Well, the president wanted to give the networks, this president, President Trump, wanted to give the networks a reason to carry him live from the Oval Office on Tuesday night. And so this idea of an emergency declaration floated around, and people on the Republican side on Capitol Hill threw up their hands and said, please don't do that. This is a bad precedent. This is not something we want to see our president doing, declaring emergencies that the country does not necessarily recognize as such. That's a bad precedent. So the president was getting pushback on that, as he's been getting pushback on this shutdown, and he decided not to take the emergency declaration step, at least not yet. But you know, Michael, an awful lot of people expect that he will be doing it. He will be declaring an emergency before this is over, because it might be the only way he can climb down, push the whole matter into the courts, let the government reopen, and live to fight another day.
So other than pushing for the wall and saying some rather partisan things about how the only solution can be if the Democrats come forward and the government is shut down because of the Democratic Party or Democratic legislators, there really wasn't much new in this speech. In fact, somebody, I think it was Chuck Todd, said it's just another stump speech.
It was parts of his stump speech, and there was a great deal of speculation as to who the principal author might have been. Obviously, all presidents have speechwriters, and all presidents read from scripts and teleprompters.
Yeah, excuse me, Ron, do we know who the speechwriter was with this? Was it Stephen Miller, perhaps?
I think Stephen Miller is certainly the likeliest suspect. I think Maggie Haberman of the New York Times said that she saw Donald Trump's face on television, but kept hearing Stephen Miller's voice in her ears. And that surely is a fair statement, even if he did not pen the speech literally. Stephen Miller's ideas and his language formulations and his attitudes seem to be on virtually every page or in every line. So if he didn't literally write the speech, he certainly had a good deal of influence over it. And this is the young 30-ish aide to Jeff Sessions, who joined the Trump campaign a few years ago when he was first running for president, a true believer, and who has been very close by the president's side ever since, and has the title of domestic advisor.
It was one of the one of those speeches that reminded me of all the carnage speech that we heard in the inauguration speech, which I think was pretty much ghosted by Bannon, but Stephen Miller played a singular role, Stephen Miller being one of the only survivors in this Trump administration at this point. Let me give out the number and invite you to join us. In fact, we'd like to hear your thoughts about last night's speech, if you heard it, and any questions you might have, and we'd welcome your involvement, and you can join us right now at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. Please feel free to join the program. Again, you can do that, 866-733-6786, by calling us. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post any questions or comments you have there at kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and we're coming to you live from KQED in San Francisco. We're talking about President Trump's Oval Office address and the situation, the ongoing situation at the border, which he called a security crisis. We talked earlier with Salvador Rizzo of the Washington Post, and we also spoke with our own Marisa Lagos. And now we have Ron Elving with us from NPR News and Julie Small here in studio, KQED's criminal justice and immigration team. And I was just saying to Julie off air that the president talked in his speech last night about, well, the humanitarian crisis, but also spoke about how he saw suffering and he held people's hands and, you know, trying to present himself as a president of empathy and humanity. And I'm wondering, the picture that he gave us was of a caring president, and there was a picture of a kind of suffering that he was attuned to in some ways, or at least trying to present himself as being attuned to. What was your reaction to that, Julie, as a reporter?
Well, I guess I feel that those murders were incredibly violent and brutal and horrible, and we can't just dismiss them outright. You know, that because it's only a handful of people, I mean, he really elevated the suffering of a few people to this national spotlight. But the logic of it doesn't make sense to me, you know, that if you had kept all these immigrants out, this would never have happened. We don't know also, like, what good immigrants might do. Maybe they save people. Maybe they prevent crimes. It's just sort of the logic of it doesn't make sense. But I did think, you know, it was powerful to the audience that he was speaking to when he talked about, you know, just building a wall around your house doesn't mean you hate the people on the outside. It means you love the people on the inside. And I think, you know, a lot of us could probably relate to that. But his actions sort of belie that, because I feel that his actions to the people on the outside has been very hostile. And the empathy that he provided to these families who suffered these brutal murders of their loved ones, it did not extend to the immigrants who are coming here, because they've been brutalized and they've seen people murdered in their countries.
Ron, I want to get your reaction to some of this, but can I go to something else with you first? I'm also interested, before we go to our calls and emails, in hearing from you on some really big news. Rob Rosenstein has essentially tendered what looks like a resignation in a few weeks, and I don't know how that's going to go over in terms of the ongoing Mueller investigation. But now you've got Paul Manafort essentially having shared poll data that has come out, and all the Mueller investigation. Some of this was redacted, of course, but it's come out that tied to Russian intelligence during the campaign, and that speaks of collusion.
We have been wondering for many months just what Robert Mueller might be finding out about the relationships between elements of the Trump campaign in 2016 and elements of Vladimir Putin's inner circle. And we have known for some time that Paul Manafort had done work for people who are close to Vladimir Putin, who were part of the Ukrainian government, and some of the back and forth between the Ukrainian government and Moscow during the years when Putin had a puppet running Ukraine for him. And that man employed Paul Manafort. So we know that there were relationships here. We know there were some rather large debts that were incurred by Paul Manafort. We know that he had business relationships with a number of people, including one by the name of Deripaska, who's very close to Putin. And it now eventuates from apparently
I'm sorry to interrupt you. He was closer with Konstantin Khlimnik, wasn't he? That was the manager.
Well, that is the person who seems to have been the go-between,
right,
in the case of what we're talking about right now. And that is some polling data from the 2016 Trump poll. The Trump campaign, rather, in 2016. This is not a public poll. This is not something you could have found in the newspapers or online. This is inside Trump material, inside information from the Trump campaign that was being shared back and forth with a Russian, Konstantin Khlimnik, who has these connections, who has these ties to the kinds of people that we have been finding murky and finding suspicious with respect to what their interests in Mr. Trump's election might be. And we know that the Putin regime was using a variety of techniques to boost Trump's prospects. So this looks like collusion. Now, all we know for this moment is that the Mueller investigators were putting this forward to a judge. We know that the prosecutors were planning to talk about this. And so now we know a little bit more of what did not come out, because that last trial for Paul Manafort was obviated when he pled guilty. This brings some to the fore of the material that we were thinking we might see back in September, but as I say, got obscured because that trial never went forward. This looks more like evidence of collusion than perhaps anything we have seen thus far. As we say, not finally proven, only part of the prosecution team's case. And if so, it is a big game changer and a big eyebrow raiser, and could have something to do with some of the other strategic thinking going on in the White House right now.
And any thoughts about the Rosenstein resignation, particularly in light of William Barr, who has made some statements that seem to put him at odds with an ongoing belief or credibility of the Mueller investigation?
As I understand it, he is planning to stay until Barr is confirmed and in place, possibly taking part in some transition. But he has said from the beginning of the Trump administration he expected to serve for about 2 more years. It sounds like it might be that almost to the day, depending on how long it takes to get Barr confirmed. That may last into February. But it appears that it will be on about that 2-year timetable that he had set a couple of years ago. It doesn't look like a firing. There is no clear sign that he is being forced out. And yet, of course, it just completes the picture of a takeover of the Justice Department by people who are not in any sense beholden to preserving and continuing the Mueller investigation. That could also have something to do with what appears to be an acceleration of the Mueller investigation's reporting, charging, and carrying through of its mandate.
Let's hear what's on the minds of our listeners and or on their hearts. Let me go first to you, Neil. You're on. Good morning.
Yeah, if you could talk, guests could talk a little bit about the definition and the use from the president and his opposition on illegal immigrants. I could be wrong, but it seems that Trump is intentionally putting in that category all the groups of asylum seekers that he wishes weren't asylum seekers, like victims of domestic violence, people who enter the country and seek asylum once they're in the country rather than the port of entry. All of these moves that he is challenging but that haven't been successful yet, and it seems that the left and the right, or the president and the opposition, are talking past each other on the numbers of illegal immigrants, and that nuance doesn't seem to get fleshed out in the media much. I could be wrong, but if your guests could talk about that and maybe the numbers of immigrants that fall into those categories.
You could be right, too. Julie, you want to comment on this?
I would say that's spot on. I mean, this has been happening a lot, that lumped in with people who have some sort of criminal background who are seeking entry are all the people who came to ports of entry who were turned away and then may have crossed between ports of entry because they were turned away at the legal port of entry. People are being prosecuted for entering to seek asylum. Very questionable that they actually broke the law, that they, you know, that they in fact have a right to seek asylum even between ports of entry. That's, you know, coming up in the courts. We're going to see some legal stuff over that. But yeah, I think it gets all lumped together, and you have to be very careful when reading press releases from Border Patrol, from the administration, about who they're arresting and who these criminal aliens are, because now a criminal alien is anyone who entered without papers.
Well, the numbers are indeed mashed together in many ways. That's really quite disturbing. But also, what about the numbers, Ron Elving? I want to get back to what I think of as an attempt by the president essentially to sell the American people on this. You said, indeed, he's probably talking more to the base and talking more perhaps to members of the Republican Party and those on the right in the world of journalism or alleged journalism. But I'm wondering also about the fact that most every poll seems to show that the president's idea of a wall is simply not supported out there in Peoria or wherever.
It seems actually a bit surprising that with all the emphasis that's been put on this by the president, and with all of the border security talk that we have had all the way back really to 9/11 and the turnaround in our attitude towards immigration, and particularly the turnaround in the Republican Party's attitude towards immigration. Back in the 1980s, the Republican Party was supportive. Ronald Reagan was highly supportive of immigration, and Ronald Reagan even used the word amnesty in signing the 1986 Immigration Reform Act. So there has been a big change in the last 15, 20 years, and the language has changed a great deal. And given all of that, one would expect that there would be stronger even support among Donald Trump's base and among Republicans more generally for this concept of the wall. But it does not seem to have really caught the public imagination in the same way that other aspects of the Trump program have. It does not seem to have been adequately sold. And so the president, perhaps falling back on some of his background in the real estate world, seems to be ratcheting up constantly his characterization of what the issue or the problem or the crisis in his language actually is, and whether or not it would justify something as extreme as building a wall or something as extreme as closing the border or declaring a national emergency, all things he is apparently considering as options.
More of your calls. We go next to you, Mark. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, thanks. Let's keep in mind there's a 600-mile existing wall that was built beginning in 1994 with Clinton all the way up through Obama that the Democrats, 80% of the Congress, supported. And this is clearly political theater and hypocrisy on the part of the Democrats to try to pretend that this is something new that they don't support. And anyone who thinks that 30,000 apprehensions a month is not a security crisis has to be kidding themselves.
Response from you, Ron Elving.
Yes, I would say that if that particular number is a crisis, then when it was many times over greater than that several years ago, it would have been several times more of a national crisis. And as far as this characterization of the wall is already being partially built, there is fencing, there is partial wall over portions of the border, as one would expect, certain parts of it around the crossing points. But anything like the president's wall would require another $25 to $40 billion to complete. That is clearly an animal of another order entirely.
What about the president saying that Senator Chuck Schumer was indeed once a very strong supporter of having a wall?
A strong supporter of fencing, no question about it. I think any major Democrat has at times supported some forms of fencing, some forms of heightened border security, more Border Patrol agents, more technology, more drones, more of the kinds of things that actual border officials usually call for. If you talk about giving them more money, they don't talk about building a wall across the mountains and a wall across the desert and a wall all the way from the Pacific to the Gulf of Mexico.
Read a comment from Tiven, one of our listeners, who writes, why do so many people still utilize and fall for the demagoguery and race baiting in American politics? America has seen so many cycles of fear-mongering and the criminalization of groups in politics. How and where does it keep being affected? You want to take that, Ron?
People do respond to the kinds of language that we hear oftentimes from politicians. They respond to that language because it's carefully crafted to induce that response. People have real, legitimate concerns about the safety of their families, the safety of their friends, the safety of travel, the safety of their own personal bodies. They want to feel safe. And if you tell them that they are not safe and that there is a person out there or a category of persons, particularly if they are foreign, if they seem exotic, if they seem threatening in some way, if you tell them that there is much to be feared from that group or that that group is going to make them less safe, there is a portion of them that automatically is going to take that seriously. And if you know how to manipulate that part of us all, you can induce a certain amount of fear and change a certain amount of behavior and make people even more fearful than they actually need to be.
I'm going to read another comment from a listener who writes, we have an alleged housing crisis in California due to a shortage of homes. If 8 million illegal immigrants in California were deported and or denied employment and education through E-Verify, there would be a housing surplus. Have to chew on that one for a while. And here's Rick, who writes, perhaps it might be more expedient to discuss what the president said that was actually true. Seriously, what was said last night that was verifiably true? Ron Elving?
I'm working on that one.
All right. We've got to work on the first one, too.
Yeah. Salvador, I think, said this well at the beginning of the program when he said the very first misstatement was in the very first sentence. And the casting of the entire 14 minutes of the president's presentation was so shot through with deceptive representations and misleading descriptions that it's really hard to say. I guess you could say that it was true what the president said about the need for there to be some kind of bipartisan action. Yes, both parties are going to have to agree on something, but it is not true to say that both parties have to agree on building the kind of wall that the president wants, because that does not need to happen for the government to reopen. All that needs to happen for the government to reopen is for the president to be willing to sign the bills that say, here's the funding for the government, let's get back to work.
And Julie Small, it's, I think, pretty evident that when we're talking about, well, the ongoing, never refer, let's call it the quasi-crisis or whatever is going on in the border, that there has to be at least some recognition of the fact that we need humanitarian. You saw that firsthand, the need for humanitarian aid. And the president did address that to some degree last night.
He did mention that there ought to be some funds made available for that, for increased medical care. And
for more immigration officers?
More immigration officers, yes. But it's interesting, too, because he called it a growing humanitarian security crisis at the southern border. But when he was saying humanitarian crisis, he was actually referring to people who were being killed by illegal immigrants, not to the tens of thousands of people who are being held along the border in these makeshift facilities with their children without enough food or water for an increasingly long period of time. We have the detention facilities are all filled up because the government adopted this policy of, you know, not prioritizing who to detain. And so those are full. And so people end up on the Border Patrol facilities longer. I kept hearing examples of people being passed back and forth between these freezing cold rooms and what looks like a dog kennel, back and forth, which is unusual. It's not happened before. It's usually you're going one way. But they were sort of like held there for a week before they were transferred to detention. One man told me that all they were given to eat was a frozen burrito in the morning the size of a soap bar, cold bean burrito. His son, who was 7, ate it for the first 3 days but couldn't continue to eat it, just would rather go hungry.
Let me also mention, because we spoke with Marisa Lagos earlier about the president's tweet today saying essentially that there should be a withdrawal of funds from California, from FEMA. The support, Ron, you can correct me on this if I don't have it exact, but the support for Central American countries to reduce gang activity and kidnapping and the kind of domestic abuse and violent problems that lead many people out of those countries like Guatemala and Honduras has been cut off.
The president has at least threatened to cut it off. I am not absolutely sure that that has been effectuated. There have been a number of times the president has said he's going to do something and his departments in one way or another either drag their feet or don't directly do it. So I wouldn't testify that it has all been cut off, but certainly the president has used that language. The idea there being that we would punish these countries for allowing these folks to leave or for not doing enough to keep them from leaving would not necessarily change the policies of some of these governments that have been a large part of why some of these migrants have chosen to leave. Some of them are leaving crime. Some of them are leaving because of the lack of security in their neighborhoods and towns. That could be laid at the feet of the government as well. But others are leaving because of suppression or oppression on the part of their actual governments. So if, in a sense, that were the problem and that could be addressed by cutting off funds to those governments, that might make a certain amount of sense. But I don't think that you can put all of those, connect all those dots in that way and say this is the purpose of the policy and the result that it would have. I think most experts think that cutting off funds to these countries would have actually a counterproductive effect and probably make all the more people desperate enough to set off in the hands of untrustworthy people to be taken through Mexico and dropped at the border of the United States.
Now, we've been hearing a number of times on this program about the importance or necessity of a Marshall Plan. Some, in fact, rhetorically tie it to American involvement in Central America, creating many of the problems, but that's for another day to discuss in another way. Let me bring Elizabeth on next. Elizabeth, join us. You're on the air.
Hi, I live in Oakland, California, so my attitude and perspectives are influenced by living in a liberal bubble. I have a question about the 25th Amendment to remove a president. I busily live my life. I think that the cabinet members have to be part of implementing the 25th Amendment. And instead of with President Trump, the cabinet members are resigning and, you know, saying he needs officials who will cooperate with him. So I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the call. We always hear about the 25th Amendment. Ron, you want to opine?
Yes, the cabinet members do have to get involved. It is essentially an action taken by the cabinet, and it would then empower the vice president. And in fact, this has never been used. No one's ever really tried to do it to anyone's knowledge. But it appears from the way that it's written that the best way for it to actually take place would be if it were led by the vice president as a means of at least temporarily relieving the president of his duties for reasons perhaps having to do with incapacity, that that would then empower the vice president to carry on. This might be used in a military situation if the president were missing or a president were in some sense or another wounded, or if a president had gotten so ill he could not carry on. The 25th Amendment could be used to transfer his powers to the vice president. But it envisions a situation in which the cabinet, the vice president, were doing this because they were forced to do it by the president's incapacity and not in any sense as a kind of coup d'etat or as a kind of way of resisting the policies or the personality of the president.
And Ron Elving, again, is senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk of NPR News. And Julie Small here in studio with us is a reporter for KQED's Criminal Justice and Immigration Team. Let me read a comment by Lori and get your response, Julie. She writes, last Sunday, I heard an interview on NPR with the mayor of McAllen, Texas, with a nuanced view of the border issues. It occurred to me that a possible solution to the wall drama is to call a conference of the mayors of the border cities to discuss and offer solutions to the border problems as they have the best understanding of the issues. Some thoughts on that?
Well, that sounds like a good idea. Yeah.
Does to me, too. In fact, yeah. I was struck by the reading about Rio Grande. There were a number of resolutions in Rio Grande cities. They want more security by the border, but they don't want a wall.
Right, right. And, you know, they also understand the value of the relationship because they're right on the border and you have people who have relatives on the other side and a familiarity. There's not that level. I don't think there's that level of fear of the unknown. And you have people that are invested in it turning out well and us having a porous but not open border, but a porous one.
Let's bring some more of our calls in. We'll be as porous as we can here. Alexandra is next. Alexandra, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if you could talk about, it seems to me there's some sort of like an assumption that seems to be going unquestioned in the media that Democrats or the left definitely does want better border security and that, you know, by default, we definitely do want to spend more money on border security. I think, you know, the talking points that I've been hearing on NPR is that immigration is down, families are in crisis, there's a humanitarian issue, mostly of the president's making of his policies is kind of my stance, my understanding of the situation. And so I can understand that we might compromise and say, okay, we'll give $1 billion to additional border security. But are we really allowing the president and the Republicans to set the tone of the debate by forcing us to say that, yes, we do agree that $1 billion, $2 billion, whatever the amount is, needs to be spent on border security? I mean, is that a de facto assumption that we all have?
That's a good and important question. And I think, Ron Elving, I'd like to hear your answer. But Democrats have put forth at least a compromise possible plan and lower money.
That's right. And it would focus largely on technology, focus largely on drug interdiction, and also try to address the migrant migrant crisis that consists of the actual humanitarian situation of gravity at this particular time. As we've been hearing, there are people at the border, asylum seekers, people who have not actually been trying to enter the country illegally, but want to enter the country legally as asylum seekers. So yes, they have supported some of that. And the caller is quite correct. The Democratic Party, if left to its own devices, includes a lot of people who would like to abolish ICE. Literally abolish the agency that is administering the border security at this point. And I have a real suspicion of the motivations of people in Homeland Security. So that's a radically different viewpoint with respect to the border. And there are people who not only a porous border, but an open border appeals to. They are not a majority of the Democratic Party, certainly not in Congress. But many of the new people who have been elected in 2018 have campaigned on openly abolishing ICE and taking a quite different view of the entire immigration issue in general, quite different from what we hear from Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. And, you know, we're familiar with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and some of the other new members saying some very different things reflective more of the caller's notions of what we should be emphasizing, or what the Democrats ought to be emphasizing with respect to immigration in general.
The Democrats are saying, in effect, let's keep these separate. Let's continue to negotiate, but let's not have the wall hold us up and have 800,000 people not getting their paychecks.
The Democrats do appear to be united about the wall. They're united against the wall. And if the Democrats were to regain the White House in 2020, if they were to regain enough power in Congress to actually be setting the national agenda and priorities, they would probably have a real struggle over what exactly they want to do on the border. Not a wall, that much is clear, but what exactly they would do to determine the policy on asylum, the policies that would determine how many people were coming through, and exactly how we enforce those laws and what kinds of force we might use in certain instances, that would probably be an occasion for a great deal of debate among the Democrats, and I suspect it will be among their 2020 presidential candidates.
Is it not true, though, Ron Elving, that the majority of those who work at the border, Customs Border Patrol people, are in favor of the wall? That's my understanding.
The Customs and Border Control people in the union that supports Donald Trump has been consistently supportive of Donald Trump. That is correct. As for how all the people feel in that agency, that is a little bit more difficult to determine. When you ask them what they want most, it is often the kind of reinforcements, the bodies, the technology, the drones, things of that nature that would come as a higher priority to the wall. There are some Republican congressmen along the route of the wall who support it, and there are some, particularly in Texas, who do not support the idea of a wall. So it's a little bit more of a mixed bag than that, even among those who are generally supportive of President Trump's stricter controls on immigration as a whole.
I'm going to read one final tweet here. A listener writes, or tweets, why is the number $5 billion now? It's way below any realistic cost estimate. And why the change from concrete to steel? A 2,000-mile rusting hulk is not a good look. Let me thank you, Ron Elving. Always good to have you with us. Appreciate you being with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael.
Ron Elving, senior editor and correspondent on Washington Post with NPR News. And thank you, Julie Small. Good
thank
to have you.
You. Pleasure to be here.
Julie Small is reporter for KQED's Criminal Justice and Immigration Team. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum up ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, who believe that all people deserve access to education and culture to enrich a lifetime of exploration and learning.